Welcome to The Common Health, the podcast of the CSIS Bipartisan Alliance for Global Health Security. In it, we delve deeply into the puzzle at home and abroad that connects pandemic preparedness and response, HIV/AIDS routine immunization, primary care, and the geopolitical impacts these have on human and national security. The Common Health replaces under a single podcast the Coronavirus Crisis Update, Pandemic Planet, and AIDS Existential Moment. Please join me, J. Stephen Morrison, and my co-hosts, Catherine Bliss and Andrew Schwartz, as we explore this new era of health security and what it means for U.S. leadership. This is The Common Health. Andrew and I are delighted today to be joined by Joe Grogan. Welcome, Joe, and thanks. You're in from London and taking time out of your visit to be here with us in the studio. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
I want to first thank you for being part of the CSIS Bipartisan Alliance for Global Health Security. We're delighted that you're part of that. We're trying to get the members of the alliance engaged in exactly this fashion. And so it's terrific to be able to do this. Let me say a few words about you. You served in the Bush administration. We first met, actually, 20 years ago, when you were the first executive director of the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV and AIDS in the administration of President George W. Bush. I don't know if you recall that, but we came when you were directing that, we came and made a presentation to the group, and you were a little skeptical about at the time, but that was our first encounter. I remember very vividly going there. We made a presentation. I don't remember exactly what it was. But you weren't convinced, but that was okay. You know, it was nice engagement. Subsequent to that, you worked in the private sector with Amgen, Gilead Sciences. We worked very closely with Gilead over the years. Most recently, you came in to OMB during the Trump administration as Associate Director of Health Programs at OMB, and then moved to be the domestic policy advisor during the period of COVID in 2020, right?
Until May 2020. So from the beginning, and then I left in the spring.
So you saw you were there in that incredible period. Maybe we can get you to talk about the first phase of the pandemic. More recently, you founded Fire Arrow, which is a firm that helps innovators navigate the pitfalls of Washington, D.C., innovators in the pharmaceutical industry.
Predominantly some other innovative tech companies and devices, too.
Steve, I have to jump in for one second, though, because, Joe, I have to tell you, Steve is like a major league Hall of Fame pitcher. He remembers every pitch he ever threw. So that's why he remembers 20 years ago.
I got to say, it's very impressive.
It is. Sorry to interrupt, Steve.
No, that's fine. That's fine. Thanks. So, Joe, in November, you wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal reflecting on how the Inflation Reduction Act that the Biden administration had successfully won passage of through Congress and signed into law, that gave power to the government to negotiate drug prices for Medicare. And you were critiquing that in terms of how that upset existing bipartisan legislative understandings around trying to manage incentives and pricing, particularly around rare diseases and the like. Can you explain, just give our listeners a quick recap of the critique that you brought forward, and then also what you saw as steps that could ameliorate some of those inadvertent side effects?
Sure. So, I think why the Inflation Reduction Act stands out for healthcare legislation is because 100% of Democrats voted for it and zero Republicans voted for it. Contrast that with Hatch-Waxman, which was Senator Orrin Hatch from Utah, very conservative on the Senate side, and then Henry Waxman, California Democrat on the House side. They collaborated in really building the bipartisan legislation that created a robust innovation engine in the United States with a robust generic industry. I mean, over 90% of drugs in Medicare are generics. They set up a system where the innovators have a period of time of monopoly beyond just the patents, but marketing exclusivity. And then in exchange for that and the handing over of data to the FDA and the approvals, they surrender those rights, and then generics take over and prices collapse after that, and it becomes a commodity business. That system worked brilliantly to make us the number one, the United States, the number one place to do biopharmaceutical research. It created, in terms of public health, really the arsenal of democracy. If you think about vaccines, if you think about antibiotics, if you think about all these medicines that we use to improve the human condition, so many of them that were so important, obviously, during COVID, when we built upon that infrastructure, that Hatch-Waxman's responsible for that. And it's been reauthorized and amended numerous times. The Prescription Drug User Fee Act, the model for the medical device user fees and their exclusivities, a lot of these things have been built upon this, the interactions. And then the creation of Part D was made possible by Hatch-Waxman. And then the Democrats come in and on a hardline partisan vote decide that Medicare is going to negotiate drugs after 9 years for small molecule drugs and 13 for biologic drugs. And in theory, maybe it sounds fine. Okay, it basically ends those exclusivity periods after 9 and 13 years. And I don't pretend that everything was perfect with the old system and that companies and distributors didn't abuse it, but the devil's in the details. And what this has really done is destroy so much of the motivation to innovate and to develop new indications. Number of clinical programs have been shut down by companies. And it's really, I'll tell you what people don't realize, it's going to decimate the generic industry too. They are spinning with what the administration has planned on how to implement this, the motivation to bring the generic drugs to market. And a lot of these policy documents that they're releasing about how this is going to be done is terrifying innovator companies, but also generic companies as well.
So let's talk about some of the fixes that you've proposed. You published a longer study with some other authors through the USC, the Schieffer Center, its white paper series. You're talking about maybe there should be some fixes in adjusting the way that prices are set with a greater emphasis on social value. And you're also saying that perhaps there should be more flexibility if a firm develops a drug and invests in additional indications, additional uses beyond the original, that perhaps that there's adjustments in the price setting. And you're also focusing on penalties, more flexibilities in penalties. Explain a bit more what that means. What does it mean to put more emphasis on social value in the determination of price?
Yeah, I think the central thesis with this is that if the government's going to negotiate prices, we have to do the best job we can figuring out what variables it's going to take into effect. I'm pessimistic about overturning government negotiating prices. To be frank, I don't think they should, but I don't think, even if Republicans were to take over everything, I don't see any way this is going to get fixed overnight and we're going to go back to the old way. So how do you evaluate it? It's not simple, you know, to figure out what is this drug worth it to Steve for him to not have a heart attack in 7 years? What is it worth to your children, your families? What is it worth in comparison to, say, a COVID cure, a COVID treatment? And figuring out what goes into those variables is really important. And it can't just be done in secret. And it can't just be a question of how much are the Europeans getting this drug for? I mean, we have built an entire infrastructure in the United States around valuing pharmaceuticals. There are companies that do it. They hire economists from all over the country, all over the world to collaborate on this. And we have to get this right. So figuring out not just how much can a company charge, but how much value does a product give to society as far as productivity, economic growth? If your ability to walk and be out of pain, how do you evaluate the value of that to you, to your employer here at CSIS, that you're more productive, you're able to do more if you are free of pain? These are all questions that need to be evaluated, and I don't think the government is currently set up to do it. One of the co-authors on the paper, Darius Lakdawala, brilliant economist, he's done a lot of work on this, as has Dana Goldman from the Schieffer Center, in figuring out different models that the government could use to deploy to figure out how much a product should be reimbursed for.
Yeah.
Well, I was struck by how much in the longer study you were focused on some very pragmatic adjustments to try and correct for these, what you see as the inadvertent side effects of the IRA, the changes.
I think the other point is they really did eliminate a lot of the motivation for additional indications to be done. I mean, if you look at some of these cancer drugs, you get one indication, then you do more clinical trials, which are expensive, and you prove out the case bring that data to FDA and you get more exclusivity, you get more rewards for that. A lot of that motivation has been demolished by the Inflation mm-hmm. Reduction Act. I don't think that's good for society to have pharmaceutical companies not gathering those data, right, to gather data and to share it with the public and to share it with physicians and to continue to innovate and find new therapies or new uses for their therapies. Yeah.
Let's move on now to talk a little bit about next gen. Andrew, you want to jump in?
Sure. Thanks, Steve. So let's talk about the proposed next gen $5 billion. It may or may not happen, particularly if the negotiations over lifting the debt ceiling involves reclaiming surplus COVID money. What do you think the prospects for moving this forward are, and what arguments will work best to keep a priority focus on better vaccines and therapies for COVID?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, we're not in a minor financial bind in the United States. I mean, our 12-month deficit is $1.92 trillion in a time of peace. That's a lot of money. Now, in the context, $5 billion isn't that much. Let's just spend $5 billion more on this initiative to make sure we can get the ability to develop treatments quickly. It's a goal I certainly share, but in the context of the debt ceiling, which frankly is an absurdity that we're not hashing out a bipartisan solution to this, I can very easily see it fall out and not and be deprioritized. How do you keep it at the top of the agenda? Unclear to me. You know, who are the champions on the Hill that are really going to carry it? I mean, I know CSIS has established a relationship with Richard Burr, who had a proven track record of bipartisanship and a ton of achievements, well-respected on the Democratic side of the aisle. You need people like that that are going to fight for it. And I don't see people with chops the way Senator Burr had really pushing this forward and saying this is something that needs to get done. And the other thing, we have a problem in the United States of as soon as a crisis is over, we get distracted by the next thing. And unfortunately, I could very easily see this not being the biggest priority for either the Biden administration or for Democrats and Republicans on the Hill.
You know, the broader picture is it's thought that there are somewhere between 50 and 70 billion of unused funds, COVID funds, but they're scattered across a patchwork of different government agencies, and recovering them is going to be difficult and complicated, but it doesn't get us very far towards really addressing that deficit of 1.4 trillion or 1.92 trillion. The interesting thing is Ashish Jha, who's going to join us later this week for a podcast also. I mean, this is something that really is sort of the last major act of his tenure as a COVID coordinator. He's been trying to really develop the base of interest in industry and university researchers at NIH around developing vaccines that have a nasal spray application and stop infection better, have universality across many different types of coronavirus, but also to keep a focus on getting new therapies, getting monoclonals back in the action. He is having to make an argument to an audience that's not that interested in this anymore. But he's also been able to say that there's lots of promising biotech initiatives that are in phase one and some in phase two, that he does think that this $5 billion could sort of pull promising prospects forward in a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah, I hate to say it. The fact that the money's there, $5 billion, which in the context of a pharmaceutical company and the industry isn't that much, but you need a company that wants to move it from two through three and really develop that molecule and then market it or leave it on the shelf for the right time. You look at what happened to Moderna recently, where they got hauled before Senator Sanders' help committee, and that CEO got dragged through the mud. The question for a CEO is going to be, is the government going to be a good partner? I don't know that $5 billion is enough. It may be for some startups to do the research and everything, but you really need the companies that want to be in this game and develop it. Discovering the molecule is one problem. Developing it, commercialization is another problem. And in the context of everything else that's going on, I don't know that $5 billion moves the ball that far. And I'm more worried about this war that we're waging upon innovators who have the audacity to be successful and make money for their companies, their shareholders, and themselves.
Yeah, Joe, can I follow up on that? It's really interesting. It's hard to understand for, you know, regular Americans how there can't be bipartisanship on something that really will save lives. You know, it's just, how do you wrap your head around that?
Well, I mean, so it's easy to say that it's all due to cynicism, but there are real intractable differences about the role of government and what to do. And, you know, I agree with Steve, $5 billion isn't that much in the context of everything, but it's $5 billion here, it's 50 here, it's 25 here. And it's easy for somebody up there on the Hill to say, I don't have a lot of constituents, I don't have a lot of voters, I don't have a lot of donors that are clamoring at me to get this $5 billion passed through. And that's why, like I said before, losing guys like Burr and before him, Ted Kennedy would have been, you know, he had a tremendous track record of bipartisan healthcare achievements. I don't see a lot of those people coming up through the ranks on the Republican and Democrat side who can broker these types of divides, unfortunately.
But we are going to need them. I mean, the point you're pointing to, the imperative to cultivate the next round of leadership here around these ideas and make it worth their while so there's not a downside politically. And they can go out and say, look, we are preserving the power of innovation. It's a bipartisan enterprise. We have to be a reliable and predictable partner with the private sector innovators over the long haul. This can't be hit and miss. Mm-hmm. We can't just lead people down a path and then leave them without an ability to carry this forward, which gets to sort of the broader question around the long-term R&D agenda for health security. I mean, the $5 billion is for COVID vaccine and COVID therapies. So it's narrow. There's also been this big picture effort by the Biden administration to map out the full spectrum of the 26 categories of viral families and to think comprehensively about what a strategy of trying to invest in R&D long-term with private sector partners would look like. And they put forward these tremendously large, what were called mandatory budgets, initially $88 billion, and then they shrunk that down to $23 billion, but still budget proposals that were unrealistic, politically and fiscally unrealistic. But it leaves us now with this gap, this big question of, well, what should, in the current environment right now, what should we be telling the American people should be our research and development priorities beyond COVID, just as a matter of national security and as a matter of top line priority? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's no way you can avoid the vaccine question. I mean, we have to continue to invest in vaccine development. Obviously, the mRNA technology is an unbelievable advance and has allowed us to create vaccines much more quickly. I think there are other things that can be done and other emerging technologies out there that are incredibly exciting. From as simple, you know, not simple, but one thing in the news, but artificial intelligence. I mean, can we speed molecule discovery time down significantly with AI, bring costs down to from discovery and through development? I mean, there's a lot of things that can be done. I don't see how we don't make it a priority. And I think NIH's budget needs to be seriously scrutinized. You mentioned HIV, which is where I started in public health. I'm very proud of the tiny role I played in PEPFAR and the reauthorization of Ryan White Care Act. HIV continues to command a tremendously outsized proportion of the NIH budget at a time when it's now a survivable disease and with pre-exposure prophylaxis, preventable disease. I don't deny the fact that we need to continue to hunt for cures and better treatments for the U.S. and internationally, but how much of the NIH budget should be devoted to a disease that's no longer killing people at the clip it was when the nation made the commitment to HIV? I think we've got to rejigger the NIH budget and figure out where we want to devote resources more effectively, including for diseases like Alzheimer's. I think there's things that can be done there. But vaccine research, coronaviruses, this is all going to have to be a focus moving forward.
It was interesting to see this morning the press reporting on very promising results on mRNA, a vaccine application against pancreatic cancer. There's a piece in the papers this morning about early findings coming forward that looked very, very encouraging.
Pancreatic cancer killed my father at 53, so that would be something I'd definitely love to see.
I wanted to bring up the topic of CDC reform. You know, we've laid out a reform agenda in recent CSIS report Steve just had an op-ed in the New York Times the other day about it. We also see the House Select Committee on Coronavirus Pandemic unfolding, including a very aggressive review of the CSIS moving forward agenda. In the meantime, Director Walensky is departing at the end of June. In this polarized and uncertain environment, what reforms have the best prospect for drawing bipartisan support?
Well, that's a great question. I'm proud to have contributed somewhat to the CDC reform effort here at CSIS. I believe in it. It needs more voices calling for it. It needs more ideas on how to reform it. I'm not super optimistic about reforms. I mean, one of the big problems is the budget of CDC is really segmented, and it makes it very difficult for a CDC director to devote resources where they need to go. CDC, frankly, needs massive cultural change, I think, and it needs to refocus on its original purpose of controlling disease spread, infectious diseases, transmissible diseases, and it's gotten way too much mission creep into chronic diseases and other things that are not core. Far too many people working there are focused on publishing when they should be on disseminating data and research as quickly as possible. It needs a lot of reforms, many of which have been represented by CSIS, but I'm also kind of intrigued by what the private sector can do in this field. And when you look at what the economic damage was to the country and our inability to confront the coronavirus aggressively from the beginning, understand what was going on, there are a lot of private companies that would benefit and may be interested in investing in a data collection, dissemination, private sector alternative. That may sound crazy, but at one point, the idea of private sector space exploration was considered crazy. And now NASA is really sort of a coordinator for a lot of this private sector activity. And there's a lot of private sector activity that goes on without much input from NASA at this point.
You know, it's interesting. We've often talked on this podcast about how one of the, you know, key things CDC has to do is communicate better, and how it's, you know, mixed messages going, especially during the pandemic, were troubling, and, you know, people just didn't know what's going on. How do you think the agency can communicate better? I mean, I think they should start with hiring somebody like Ashish Jha to really, you know, be the face of the organization. You can see what a difference Jha made once he got to the White House in their communication strategy.
Yeah, I think it's not a minor problem how to communicate difficult public health messages, especially in a crisis. And the more people that can study it, train public health leaders in how to communicate it, the better. I think it's a huge glaring need out there. One thing I would suggest is for all these people to be more humble. I mean, I think Ashish, one of the reasons why he came across so well is because he came across as humble and was willing to say, we don't know, we're trying to do better, things like that. He admitted mistakes. He was approachable. He was conversational. I think you need a lot of that, a lot more of that, and the age where people are just going to respect pronouncements from the CDC or the Surgeon General or anything like that. Those days are over. And you have to accept it. You just have to accept people are going to be on Twitter. There's going to be misinformation out there. There's going to be second guessing. There's going to be talking heads. And I don't think the CDC can get defensive and lash out at people who are throwing noise out there. I think they have to be engaged, and you got to be steady, calm, and humble about what you know and you don't know, and treat the American people like adults.
Yeah, it's a really good point. In an age of misinformation and disinformation and, you know, TikTok video culture and hyper warp speed social media, it's critical to be able to communicate, you know, in an effective way, and to do what you just said, say when you don't know and, you know, this isn't true and we're looking into it and et cetera. I mean, it just has to happen.
I mean, CDC is going to need just a vastly expanded set of capacities that are non-conventional capacities. I mean, they're going to need to be using other media. They're going to have disciplinary capacities. In order to understand and rebut disinformation, misinformation, you've got to understand and be able to relate to social media and the whole formulation of algorithms. You've got to be fast. Mm-hmm. You've got to have an engineering background. You've got to have an anthropological background. You've got to have a network of other partners, private sector, community leaders. that are going to be out there ready to amplify and augment the messaging that's coming forward. There was a recent committee meeting, the committee that reviews immunization practices for CDC, the ACIP advisory committee. They were meeting one recently, and they called up and said, look, we're here debating this question of, you know, how badly are we doing against disinformation, misinformation. They have protesters right outside their door making noise. I'm like, wait, how well are we doing in this situation? And one very prominent virologist said, you know, we're in a street fight with a spoon. We're right now trying to fight a knife fight in the streets with a spoon.
Well, that's right. I mean, you, in addition to all the things that you just said, Steve, you know, people who are communicating health policy issues need to understand how ChatGPT works and what generative AI is going to mean for communication. I mean, this is a big, big problem.
Right. And, you know, I think it translates over into the CDC's ability to disseminate data. I mean, I would suggest, I mean, I don't know what your data shows, but everybody was checking out the Johns Hopkins website to figure out what was going on in COVID, not the CDC website. I mean, that's another indictment. That's communication. It's not just data, but it's how do you communicate it? How do you get it out there? And, you know, Hopkins was viewed as a more trusted source with more reliable information, as were a number of other talking heads. And I don't think it does CDC any good to pine for the old days when there weren't these avenues, there weren't these opportunities. It's got to figure out how is it going to go forward. And maybe it just says, we're going to outsource it all to an institution like Hopkins, or Hopkins and University of Washington and UCLA, UCSF. Like, it's up on five different websites. The data is provided. It's sorting through the noise and presenting it. There's five major universities that do it, or 20. I don't know. But why is CDC sitting there husbanding data when it can be communicated more effectively, more quickly by people not down in Atlanta at the CDC headquarters?
Yeah, that's a terrific idea. I mean, to have institutions that really do have the trust in this sense and collaboration, you know, amongst academic institutions, that's clearly one of the ways to go with this. Over to you, Steve.
Let's move on and talk a little bit about antimicrobial resistance. This is an issue where there was a lot of progress in terms of consciousness of this and understanding the key dimensions of better stewardship and use of antibiotics, looking at both animal use and human use, focus on trying to get the pipeline fixed because industry had insufficient motivation and predictability and guarantees to bring forward these drugs that you don't want to overuse. So you develop them, you finance them, then you don't sell a lot of them, mm-hmm. right? So the Pasteur Act was introduced in 2013, bipartisan. It's been reintroduced to try and propose a subscription model whereby the government would commit, okay, if we get certain quality of products guaranteed for purchase, that's languished. We haven't been able to sort of overcome political resistance to the notion of advanced purchase agreements with the private sector for this. And yet now we see this manifest in increasing in terms of its impact. I mean, there's about 35,000 Americans a year dying needlessly because of resistance. The question that's now front and center and something that our alliance is going to look at over the course of the summer is how realistically to move that agenda forward. One angle we're going to pursue is looking at the notion that there's quite a bit of cooperation in the transatlantic alliance. There's a lot going on. Europeans are very committed to this. They have a new entity, HERA, that's operating jointly with, can operate more jointly with our BARDA. There's a shared interest in trying to elevate this. Perhaps that's one point of light that we could exploit. But what's your sense, Joe? What's realistic here to get this agenda moving forward?
Well, I like that idea of collaborating with like-minded allies on something like this. And I hope we could bring in, you know, the Japanese into something like that and some partners in Asia to try and figure out some creative financing and spread the risk and the cost. I want to suggest it's not just in antimicrobial resistance we've got this problem. We have tremendous advances in scientific breakthroughs, treatments, cures, cell and gene therapy, and our system is not currently set up to accommodate those products. And unfortunately, unless we figure this out, we're not going to live up to the promise of what they of what these technologies can mean for improving the human condition, improving economic growth, alleviating human suffering. So this type of thinking around the Pasteur Act and antimicrobial resistance is desperately needed to come up with different creative financing mechanisms, but we need it for a whole bunch of treatments, not just in the quote-unquote public health realm, like curing infectious diseases or eradicating microbes that could be ravishing a body, but we really need to figure out how are we going to accommodate all these new technologies so that we can pull them forward and deploy them into society. And Congress needs to work in a bipartisan fashion to figure out how we're going to do it.
Do you think that, I mean, the antimicrobial resistance is a kind of slow, quiet pandemic that is harming lots of Americans. 35,000 a year in a country of 330 million people doesn't seem like a lot, but it's every year in and out, and it's increasing. And we've seen regression in the course of the pandemic, overuse of antibiotics for what were viral infections. We've seen things walk back significantly. The problem, it seems to me, is that most Americans don't yet see this as a pernicious and creeping threat, even though it is. If you go into any hospital right. system, they will tell you that they're struggling with this.
Sure.
And that it's a top of mind priority. But for your average American, when they're going off to get basic surgery, where they're going to be at risk of this, they're not. It's not yet registered.
Yeah, I mean, that's why you need leaders, not just leaders from institutions, but leaders on Capitol Hill who are willing to say, look, maybe this isn't going to get me, not going to translate into a ton of votes, but it's important for the American yeah. people, it's important for public health, and it's got to be accomplished. That's, I think, why it's so critical for different institutions to be involved and get members invested in solving some of these problems, because it's not, to your point, it's not being broadcast on the networks every night as a major public health crisis. But there are tons of families that are affected by this when their family members go into hospitals. And it is a topic of discussion. It just seems to be more a kitchen table, episodic kitchen table conversation when a family member is confronted with a hospital stay as opposed to every night on the news.
Andrew, you wanted to weigh in?
Yeah, Joe, I wanted to ask you about the Pandemic and All Hazards Preparedness Reauthorization Act. What are the arguments and approaches that'll work best, and how important is it to get a successful reauthorization of this?
Oh, I think it's pretty important that we have some type of bipartisan commitment in this area. For one thing, I think this is one thing that I've witnessed over the years is you get whenever there's a crisis or a new initiative that an administration puts into place, whether they're Democrat or Republicans, you get very top tier people for that first effort. And then over time, continuing to recruit top tier people is difficult. If our ability to recruit top tier scientists into the government to work on some of these issues, like what projects to fund, what research to prioritize, what companies should we meet with, how should we respond, think through the next pandemic response, is going to be severely impacted if the United States government and Congress doesn't make a financial commitment and an intellectual commitment to this area, because you're asking people to give up their time in the private sector. Frequently, they're making a big financial sacrifice. Often they're moving, they're making a family sacrifice, and it's a very difficult sale to go into an agency or stay in an agency if you're just functioning on appropriations and you have no idea what the direction from Congress is, the commitment from Congress to continue to fund the work and back you up when you make funding decisions or set a research agenda. So I think it's critical if we're going to be ready for the next one.
We had a conversation yesterday afternoon with a Republican member of the House, very moderate, a doctor actually, who was emphasizing, look, we got to have this. This is essential for the stockpile. It's essential for BARDA. It's essential for revalidating. This legislation originated in the midst of the crises in the early not decade, mm-hmm. and it's been around since 05. It's been reauthorized multiple times. It's a bipartisan instrument. It's terribly fundamental, foundational to our approach. But right now, the term pandemic is toxic. And so people turn off. It's like you trigger a certain reaction by simply having that word in the title.
Right.
Which I thought was a remarkable a remarkable admission of where our political environment is, where people are like, well, if this is all about pandemic drugs, we don't want to touch it. It's going to require, in this environment, it's going to require some extra engagement, some extra going an extra mile of explaining to people the importance of this and getting people on board so that it doesn't get carried off into some of our more divisive and toxic areas around this pandemic. That gets back to your point, Joe, that leadership is where this is all going to rest.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's an interesting observation. The pandemic is now a radioactive term on the Hill. But I do think there are a lot of responsible people who want to get it done. And I'm optimistic in the end it will get done. It may not be done as neatly and as expeditiously as we'd all hope. But I think this is something, depending on how the debt ceiling thing plays out and how they can get back on track, this to me seems like something in the blocking and tackling of Congress that they're gonna have to get done.
So let's close. We always close by asking our guests to tell us what gives you greatest hope and optimism in this period. You've given us a hint of that in your last answer.
I don't think it can be minimized, the advances in science that are occurring every day around the world and the tremendous ability of companies to innovate and bring new products to market that can help us fight pandemics and help improve the human condition generally. The science is advancing so quickly, it's mind-boggling. The other thing I'm optimistic about, frankly, is I do think there are a lot of people in the institutions around the country who want to see things improve and are willing to put effort into it, and people with money willing to philanthropically donate to say, hey, let's think through whether it's CDC reform or communications public health or building a new database to help us communicate data. There's a lot of energy on the right and left to figure out how we can do a better job next time. It may have to occur outside of Congress, but I do think there is energy towards improving our ability to respond next time. And if these scientific advances continue to blossom the way they are and are proven to be commercially viable, I think we're in for potentially a golden age of treatments. We just have to figure out how we're going to pay for them.
Thank you.
Joe, thanks so much for being with us today. It's a great conversation. We'd love to have you back soon.
Thanks. It was great.
Thank you for listening to The Common Health. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a follow and leave a review. To learn more about the CSIS Bipartisan Alliance for Global Health Security or listen to other CSIS podcasts, please visit csis.org.